210. Assuming, then, that in the image of the philosophers of the future there is some characteristic which raises the question whether they would not perhaps have to be sceptics, in the sense indicated immediately above, that would nonetheless indicate only one thing about them, and not what they themselves were. With just as much justification they could be called critics, and it's certain they will be men who experiment. In the names with which I have ventured to christen them, I have already particularly emphasized the attempting and the enjoyment in making attempts. Did this happen because, as critics in body and soul, they love to use experiments in a new, perhaps broader, perhaps more dangerous sense? In their passion for knowledge, do they have to go further with daring and painful experiments than is considered appropriate by the soft-hearted and mollycoddled taste of a democratic century? There is no doubt that these coming philosophers will at least be able to rid themselves of those serious and not unobjectionable characteristics which separate the critic from the sceptic. I mean the certainty in the measure of value, the conscious use of a unity of method, the shrewd courage, the standing alone, and the ability to answer for themselves. In fact, they will confess that they take delight in saying no, and in dismantling things, and in a certain thought-out cruelty, which knows how to guide the knife surely and precisely, even when the heart is still bleeding. They will be harder, and perhaps not always only on themselves, than humane people might wish. They will not get involved with the truth, so that the truth can please them, or elevate them, and inspire them. By contrast, they will have little faith that the truth brings with it such emotional entertainment. They will smile, these strict spirits, if someone should declare in front of them, "That idea elevates me, how could it not be true?" Or, "That work delights me, how could it not be beautiful?" Or, "That artist enlarges me, how could he not be great?" Perhaps they not only smile, but have a real disgust for all sorts of things enthusiastic, idealistic, feminine, hermaphroditic. Anyone who knew how to follow them right into the secret chambers of their hearts would hardly find there any intention to reconcile Christian feelings with the taste of antiquity, or even with modern parliamentarianism. A reconciliation which is said to be taking place even among philosophers in our very uncertain and therefore very conciliatory century. These philosophers of the future will demand not only of themselves critical discipline and every habit which leads to purity and strictness in things of the spirit. They could show them off as their own kind of jewelry. Nonetheless, for all that, they still don't wish to be called critics. It seems to them no small insult inflicted on philosophy when people decree, as happens so commonly today, "Philosophy itself is criticism and critical science, and nothing else." This evaluation of philosophy may enjoy the applause of all French and German positivists, and it's possible that it would have flattered even the heart and taste of Kant. We should remember the title of his major works. Our new philosophers will nonetheless affirm that critics are the tools of the philosopher, and for that very reason, the fact that they are tools, still a great way from being philosophers themselves. Even the great Chinese citizen of Königsberg, Kant, was only a great critic. 211. I insist on this point, that people finally stop confusing philosophical labourers and scientific people in general with philosophers, that in this matter we strictly assign to each his due, and do not give too much to the former and much too little to the latter. It may be that the education of a real philosopher requires that he himself has stood for a while on all of those steps where his servants, the scientific labourers in philosophy, remain and must remain. Perhaps he must himself have been critic and sceptic and dogmatist and historian, and in addition poet and collector and traveller and solver of riddles and moralist and prophet and free spirit and almost everything, in order to move through the range of human worth and feelings of value, and to be able to look with a variety of different eyes and consciences from the heights into every distance, from the depths into every height, from the corners into every expanse. But all these things are only preconditions for his task. The task itself seeks something different. It demands that he create values. Every philosophical labourer on the noble model of Kant and Hegel has to establish some large collection of facts or other concerning values, that is, earlier value statements, creations of value which have become dominant and for a long time have been called truths. They have to press these into formulas, whether in the realm of logic or politics, morality or art. The task of these researchers is to make everything that has happened and which has been valued up to now clear, easy to imagine, intelligible and manageable, to shorten everything lengthy, even time itself, and to overpower the entire past, a huge and marvellous task, in whose service every sophisticated pride and every tough will can certainly find satisfaction. But the real philosophers are commanders and lawgivers. They say, that is how it should be. They determine first the whereto and the what for of human beings, and as they do this, they have at their disposal the preliminary work of all philosophical labourers, all those who have overpowered the past. They reach with their creative hands to grasp the future. In that process, everything which is and has been becomes a means for them, an instrument, a hammer. Their knowing is creating. Their creating is establishing laws. Their will to truth is will to power. Are there such philosophers nowadays? Have there ever been such philosophers? Is it not necessary that there be such philosophers?